I will call this meeting of the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee to order. We are meeting remotely under House Rule 10.01. We will start with the roll. Anna, please go ahead.
Director Finn.
Present.
Representative Mueller.
Present.
Representative Scott.
Present.
Representative Feis.
Present.
Representative Frazier.
Present.
Representative Grossel.
Present.
Representative Herr. Representative Hollins.
Present.
Representative Johnson.
Present.
Representative Liebling.
Present.
Representative Long.
Present.
Representative Mortensen.
Present.
Representative Novotny. Representative Farr.
Present.
Representative Robbins.
Present.
Representative Vang.
Present.
Representative Sean.
Present.
All right, a quorum is present. First order of business will be to take care of the minutes from March 26th, 2021. Vice Chair Mueller, do I have a motion to approve the minutes?
So moved, Madam Chair.
All right, any discussion to the minutes? All right, seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? All right, the minutes are approved from March 26, 2021. So today, as was posted last week, we'll walk through the DE3 amendment for our omnibus bill. So we're mostly going to be hearing from House nonpartisan staff, and then we will move on to some public testimony as well. So I will move that House File 1030 be recommended to be referred to Ways and Means. As was in the posting, so we posted the bill last week on Wednesday. We wanted to make sure folks had plenty of time to read it and get up to speed. We know it's a very busy week in all of the committees as all the omnibus bills are coming out. So the only action we're going to be taking today is to move the DE3 author's amendment. So we will move that amendment, and then the nonpartisan staff will walk through the bill as amended. So with that, I will move the DE3 amendment to get this bill in the shape that we want it. So all those in favor of the DE3, please say aye.
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 Opposed? All right, the DE3 amendment is adopted, so the bill is now before us as amended, and with that, we'll move on to nonpartisan staff. Before we really get rolling this morning, I did want to take this time to thank our nonpartisan and partisan staff. This is an incredibly busy time of year for everybody, and they were not leisurely enjoying the last week of no committee hearings. They were working very hard on putting these bills together and also making sure that we know what's in the bills, because I know our partisan staff do good work for all of us in reviewing things and getting those documents as well. So I do want to thank all of them and sort of start out this week in a moment of gratitude for the work that they do for all of us. So thank you very much to our staff. And with that, we will hear more from our nonpartisan staff today than we typically do. First up, I have John Walls, our fiscal analyst, and he's going to start with the spreadsheet, and then we'll walk through the rest of the bill. So, Mr. Walls.
Madam Chair, do you want me to share screen with the spreadsheet?
That would be great, John. Thank you.
Okay. Madam Chair, is that now visible?
It is. Please go ahead, Mr. Walls.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Beginning on the first page under the Supreme Court, we have included dollars for maintain core justice operations at a slightly different level than the governor. The governor requested $2.1 million for the biennium. We included $2,051,000. We've included a slightly smaller amount for online court records access. The governor included $850,000 for this request, and the House bill contains $741,000. We also have a slight difference in cybersecurity infrastructure. The House has $375,000 for that. That is a one-time cost. The governor had requested $750,000. We have the full $1 million from the governor's request of $1 million for courthouse security grants. Madam Chair, the next three items on the spreadsheet, lines 9, 10, and 11, were member bills. I would add right off the bat that these three items will be moved in the future via amendment to district courts. They're not supposed to be under the Supreme Court, so that's something we'll be taking care of in the future. House File 75 are costs related to forfeiture reform. House File 972 is $400,000 a year to increase interpreter pay to the extent that the courts can with those dollars. And House File 707, criminal sexual conduct, this is for one additional judge unit. And again, that will be in the district courts in the future. Madam Chair, we fully funded the governor's request for civil legal services, increased services. The governor had $5.686 million in the upcoming biennium. We matched that. However, we had some additional dollars in the tails, so we gave them a slightly larger increase going forward of $3.667 million beginning in 2024. Madam Chair, that takes me to Court of Appeals. The governor had requested $542,000 for maintaining core justice operations. The House included $403,000. On the district courts, the governor had requested $15 million for ongoing for maintaining core justice operations. The House bill includes $13,039,000. Madam Chair, moving down to line 49, the guardian ad litem. The governor had requested an additional $1,095,000 for the biennium, and the House has matched that request. Madam Chair, moving to page 2, the tax court. We are again at the governor's requested level of an additional $52,000 for the biennium. Under Uniform Laws Commission, we are also at the governor's level with an additional $2,000 a year for the Uniform Laws Commission. Madam Chair, moving down to line 74, the Board of Judicial Standards, the governor had requested $148,000 to restore staffing level and services, which was an additional half FTE of funding, and we have included that. That's $148,000 for the biennium. Madam Chair, under Public Defense Board on line 81, the governor had requested money to maintain core services. And there just is a technical change for public defender payment distribution. We have included both of those. And also on line 87, there is a one-time cost of $187,000 related to post-conviction relief, and that is to hire part-time attorneys to deal with a small backlog of cases. Madam Chair, moving down to the Human Rights Commission. And Madam Chair, this will be changed on future spreadsheets. They're now called the Department of Human Rights, so that title will be changed. The governor had requested an additional 1.5 FTEs and an operating adjustment of $479,000. That is also included in the House bill. There is a governor's request of $533,000 for prohibiting racial discrimination in rental housing. And $991,000 for the biennium for improved caseload processing. That was a request for 5 FTEs. That totals about $1.5 million. The House has included just shy of $700,000 on line 99. There's $695,000, and the department is directed to use this to prohibit racial discrimination, to hire additional people to the extent money is available to improve caseload processing, and also to maintain some data on racial bias. Madam Chair, moving down to line 103, there is a small appropriation to the Office of the State Auditor from House File 75. These were costs related to forfeiture reform, asking them to do some small audits of data on forfeitures that happen every year. Madam Chair, moving down to line 108, Public Safety has a small one-time appropriation of $24,000, and that is just some computer programming changes required from House File 75 forfeiture reform. Madam Chair, on line 112, we begin the general fund revenue changes. There is a $2,000 a year revenue gain from House File 441, Certificates of Compliance. Madam Chair, we've also included on line 114 the House File 306. This is the criminal traffic surcharge waiver. You'll see in line on fiscal year 2023, there's a loss of $889,000 to the general fund. This is a loss of revenue by allowing the courts to waive the surcharge, the $75 criminal and traffic surcharge on the indigent. On line 115, House File 2257, the Ramsey County fine collection bill, this was to change the portion of dollars that would go to Ramsey County to make them equal to the way Hennepin County is treated, and that is a loss of $173,000 a year to the general fund. Madam Chair, that brings us down to two changes on revenue changes on lines 122 and 123. The human rights equal pay certificates is a revenue of $73,000 per year to the special revenue fund, and the criminal traffic surcharge waiver, that's House File 306, creates a loss of $3,000 in 2021 and $4,000 in 2022 to the game and fish fund. And Madam Chair, I believe that takes us to the end of the spreadsheet.
All right, thank you very much, Mr. Walls, and there we go. And so next up too, so that was Article 1. So moving on to Article 2 of the bill, we have Ben Johnson from House Research.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ben Johnson with House Research. I'll walk through Articles 2 and 3 and then hand it over to my colleague, Ms. Mullen. As you noted, the appropriations article, which is Article 1, is essentially the spreadsheet, so we're going to move directly to Article 2. Section 1 of Article 2 is new language to the committee. It establishes a new judge unit in the 5th District. The 5th District includes the following counties, and there are several of them: Blue Earth, Wantowan, Lyon, Redwood, Brown, Nicolet, Lincoln, Cottonwood, Murray, Nobles, Pipestone, Rock, Faribault, Martin, and Jackson. The addition brings the total number of judges there to 17. Section 2 requires the court to appoint counsel to represent each parent, guardian, or custodian who desires counsel and is financially eligible for counsel in certain child protection proceedings. Section 3 provides that a federally recognized American Indian tribe and their attorney can appear and file documents without paying a filing fee if the case they're participating in is for child support, paternity, civil commitment, public guardianship or conservatorship, or juvenile court or child protection matters. Section 4 modifies the process for allocating county program aid to reflect the change in the structure for providing and paying for public defender services as detailed in the other sections. Section 5 amends the distribution of fines, penalties, and forfeiture collected by the court administrator by providing that every municipality or subdivision of government within Ramsey County shall receive 2/3 of the money, with the balance going to the general fund. This differs slightly from the version heard in committee in that the effective date has been moved out to July 1st, 2022. Section 6 establishes an exception to the 2-year limitations period on filing a petition for post-conviction relief for a person in immigration and removal proceedings when the proceedings are the result of a conviction that was obtained by relying on incorrect advice or without advice from counsel on immigration consequences. Section 7 provides that court-appointed counsel may file an application with the district court to pay for interpreters used in meetings that take place outside of court and are also necessary to prepare an adequate defense. Sections 8, 9, 10, and 11 all shift the responsibility for appointing counsel in certain cases from the district courts to the chief public defender. Madam Chair, that's the end of the walkthrough of Article 2. I'm moving on now to Article 3. In Article 3, Sections 1, 2, and 3 all deal with the Secretary of State's Safe at Home program. They clarify provisions in that program, including identifying what mail will be forwarded, who must use a designated address for a participant, and when landlords are prohibited from publicly posting the name of a resident who is a program participant. Sections 4, 5, 6, and 7 all address the court's ability to waive that $75 surcharge that's imposed on criminal and traffic offenses. This version also differs slightly from the version heard in committee in that it has a delayed effective date that will take effect on July 1st, 2022. Section 8 requires law enforcement agencies to timely process a request from victims who are required to provide a certificate from law enforcement identifying them as crime victims to federal immigration authorities in order to support their request to remain in the United States under a U visa. Section 9 requires prosecutorial offices to collect data on their use of jailhouse witnesses, directs the Attorney General to maintain that data and report summary data describing the use of those witnesses, requires prosecutors to disclose specific information to defendants and their counsel, and requires prosecutors to notify victims if a defendant is offered a plea agreement in exchange for agreeing to testify against another person. Madam Chair, that's the end of Article 3, and I'd ask that you recognize Mary Mullen to continue.
All right. Ms. Mullen, please get us started on Article 4.
Chair and members, I'm Mary Mullen from House Research. I'm going to first walk through Article 4, which deals with the Human Rights Department and various sections of the Minnesota Human Rights Act. Section 1 deals with certificates of compliance. It adds a new section to the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act, which just creates a cross-reference to existing statute on data for certificates of compliance. Section 2, it prohibits health plans from providing coverage for anatomical gifts and organ transplants from denying eligibility or coverage based on a person's disability, or penalizing or dropping their coverage because of a person's disability related to organ transplants. Section 3 adds protected class of familial status to the public policy statement in the Minnesota Human Rights Act. Section 4 directs the commissioner of the Minnesota Human Rights Department to solicit, review, and compile reports from community organizations, schools, and individuals regarding crimes that members of the community believe are motivated by bias. Section 5 updates the language used in parts of the Minnesota Human Rights Act that require an employer to make a reasonable accommodation for a job applicant or employee when the individual has a disability. This section adds that an employer must engage in an informal interactive process to identify the limitations due to a disability and what reasonable accommodations would help with those limitations. Section 6 prevents employers, including labor unions and employment agencies, from requesting a job applicant's pay history, but it does not prevent a job applicant from volunteering their past pay if the employer doesn't prompt them. Section 7, 8, and 9 prohibit discrimination in housing against a person who is currently receiving public assistance. Section 10 clarifies that a person can file a charge with the Department of Human Rights about a discrimination claim online. Section 11 changes the dates related to the charging process in Human Rights Department claims. So it allows a person to bring a discrimination claim to request reconsideration after a decision when there's a finding that there's no discrimination. And instead of the current law, which is 10 days, it allows 30 days, and then it also allows the respondent 30 days now to respond to that section. Section 12 clarifies that a person can file a charge with the Department of Human Rights online. Section 13 allows notice of case filings to be provided electronically to the Department of Human Rights when a case is brought in court while an administrative action is still pending. Sections 14, 15, 16, 17, and 18 all deal with certificates of compliance for public contracts. Section 14 updates requirements and application of certificates of compliance for public contracts. Section 15 increases the filing fee from $150 to $250. Section 16 allows the commissioner to impose a fine for violation and allows the commissioner to suspend or revoke a certificate of compliance when those fines aren't paid. Section 17 makes conforming and technical changes related to those other provisions. And Section 18 clarifies the data classification related to certificates of compliance. Section 19 deals with equal pay certificates. It increases the filing fee for an equal pay certificate from $150 to $250. Section 20 allows the commissioner to issue a fine for a lack of compliance or suspend or revoke an equal pay certificate unless those fines have been paid, similar to what's done with for certificates of compliance. And Section 21 deals with the data classifications for equal pay certificates. It provides clarifying changes related to what they can do with the data on equal pay certificates. Section 22 prohibits discrimination by a healthcare provider or anatomical gift donor matching organization from discriminating based on a person's mental or physical disability in assessing the list for transplants and providing transplants or providing insurance for the transplants. And that is all of the article on the human rights. Article 5 relates to a number of civil law provisions. It allows public notaries who are licensed in Minnesota to register to perform marriages. Currently in Minnesota, judges and ordained ministers and religious officials can perform marriages. It also makes two temporary provisions passed during the COVID-19 pandemic permanent to allow marriage license applications to occur virtually, and it allows the harmless error rule to apply in probate cases, probate and wills and trust cases. Section 1 allows a notary to charge a larger fee than allowed to notarize a document to perform a wedding. Currently, notaries are capped at $5 to perform their notary services. Section 2 provides that notaries have the power to perform a civil marriage along with other powers notaries are granted when they have a valid notary commission. Section 3 authorizes a notary to solemnize a marriage if they have registered their notary commission with the local registrar in a county, and if they fulfill any technical requirements that mirror the requirements for a religious officiant. Section 4 adds notaries to the list of individuals able to perform marriages, and Section 5 replaces the existing law allowing one party to a marriage to apply in person for another party with a notarized statement. So this would allow the parties to do the oath virtually and for the county to accept an electronic filing of the marriage license. This provision will be retroactive to January 1st, 2021. That is when the corresponding COVID provision that was passed last year would have expired. Section 6 amends the temporary harmless error rule that was passed in 2020. So that it no longer expires on February 15th, 2021, which would make it a permanent part of the probate code. And Section 7 extends a temporary provision passed in 2020 related to filings under 336B.02, security interests related to utility or taconite companies. The bill that was passed during last spring expired on December 31st, 2021, and they want it to go through June 30th, 2022. That is all of Article 5. And I think Nathan is going to do government data practices.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Mullen. So next up, we have Nathan Hopkins, also from House Research, to walk us through Article 6. Mr. Hopkins, please go ahead.
Madam Chair and members, Article 6 contains provisions affecting government data practices. It begins on the bottom of page 47 of the DE amendment. Section 1 reestablishes the Legislative Commission on Data Practices and Personal Data Privacy. Since this provision was last heard in this committee, it received a few changes which would eliminate any costs associated with it. So members would be serving without compensation or without reimbursement for miles, meals, or other expenses. Subdivision sections 2 through 5 of this article affect the Secretary of State's Safe at Home program. Section 2 amends the definition of location data and expands the definition of real property records beyond just county recording systems. Section 3, again, Safe at Home program. This amends the provisions regarding how a program participant notifies government entities of the participant's protected status in the program. Among other changes, this adds a requirement that the participant's notice include the participant's date of birth, and that's due to the expanded size of the program. Section 4, this also affects the Safe at Home program. This makes some technical changes regarding the classification of data and data sharing. It also permits a government entity to amend its official records in order to protect a program participant's address or other location data. Section 5, this makes conforming changes to reflect the expanded definition of real property records in Section 2. It permits sharing of a participant's identity to another government entity in conjunction with real property records for purposes of administering taxation laws, and it requires the Secretary of State to be notified if there's a change regarding the protected status of a participant's property records. Section 6, this allows private educational data to be disclosed to tribal nations about tribally enrolled or descended students. Section 7, this makes a conforming cross-reference, places a cross-reference in Chapter 13 to data collected and maintained by the Attorney General regarding the jailhouse witness database, which is created under Article 3, Section 9 of the bill. Section 8, this also creates a cross-reference in the Government Data Practices Act for the new statute created by Section 7 of the bill. Oh, sorry, so this is concerning the DNR data collected regarding minors. Section 9, this regards healthcare records that are collected by law enforcement, mental health care records that law enforcement receives from other government entities or that it creates on its own, classifies the data as private or classifies it under other cross-reference statutes that classify mental health records. Section 10 creates a corrects a typo in the automated license plate reader statute. Section 11, this affects the police body camera statute. It adds a requirement that biennial audit reports be sent to relevant legislative committees in addition to the Legislative Commission on Data Practices. Section 12, this is in the statute concerning data maintained by the Ombudsperson for Corrections. It clarifies that the enumerated categories of data are public only for closed cases. Section 13, this classifies as private the enumerated kinds of data that the DNR collects about minors. It also creates an exception for data that would be classified as public because the minor is employed by the DNR, and it specifies that data on a minor remain private even after the individual turns 18. Section 14 makes changes regarding who may obtain an individual's certified birth or death record. Section 15 requires law enforcement agencies to timely process immigration-related requests from victims who are from victims of certain crimes. This is the U visa provision. And Section 16, the final section of this article, this is related to the reestablishment of the Legislative Commission on Data Practices and Personal Data Privacy. It sets deadlines for the initial appointments to the commission and sets the time for the first meeting of the commission. Madam Chair, that concludes Article 7. I believe Mr. Johnson, Article 6, I believe Mr. Johnson will be doing Article 7.
Thank you, Mr. Hopkins, and we'll turn it back to Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ben Johnson again with House Research for Article 7. Article 7 is the forfeiture bill. As the members likely recall, this article makes several changes to Minnesota's forfeiture laws, including limiting the types of offenses that can result in a DWI forfeiture, limiting the types of property subject to forfeiture under the controlled substances provisions, establishing a process for an individual to present an innocent owner claim, reducing the burden on individuals claiming to be innocent owners, requiring law enforcement agencies and prosecuting authorities to report on each forfeiture and on the use of money obtained through forfeiture, and directing the state auditor to conduct a study on the efficacy of both forfeiture and the ignition interlock program on reducing recidivism in DWI offenders. Madam Chair, that completes the walkthrough of Article 7 and the walkthrough of the Delete Everything Amendment.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Johnson. And thank you, Vice Chair Mohler, for adding 26 pages to the bill by including the forfeiture bill. Really important that we get it done this year, however, so happy to have included it. With that, we will move on to some public testimony. First on the list, well, I guess we'll take a second. Does anyone have any questions about what House Research just walked through, if there's any clarification needed on what's actually in the bill? All right. Not seeing any hands raised. So we'll move on to public testimony. First on the list, I have Commissioner Lucero. If you want to unmute yourself and introduce yourself and go ahead with your testimony.
All right. Good morning, Chair Becker Finn and members of the committee. My name is Rebecca Lucero, and I'm the commissioner for the Minnesota Department of Human Rights. And I'm here to testify today on House File 1030. I'll be brief, talking about both the budget and the policy pieces. So let's start quickly with the budget pieces. When it comes to the budget, we appreciate that you include elements of the governor and lieutenant governor's supplemental budget recommendations. First, the operating adjustment. It ensures we can maintain our current operations while supporting the underlying growth of costs, such as healthcare costs and IT services. Thank you for fully funding this in this omnibus bill. Second, we're also grateful for the additional funding that allows our department to hire additional staff to increase our investigative capacity, something that's been really important for a while, both from committee members, from the OLA, and our staff itself. Next, to strengthen the source of income discrimination protection in housing, and importantly, to improve our ability to track and report hate crimes and bias incidents. Third, we also appreciate that the omnibus bill adjusts the workforce and equal pay certificate fees, keeping them in proportion to their administrative processing costs. And just as a reminder, these fees haven't changed. The workforce fees haven't changed since their inception in 2003 and equal pay in 2014. So it's time for a slight tick up there. We appreciate that was included. With respect to the policy section, I will highlight three items that we're excited to see included. First, the inclusion of the Preventing Pay Discrimination Act. We really want to do everything we can to close the racial and gender pay gap in Minnesota. This is an important step to do so. Second, by including our technical bill and OLA recommendations, our operations and services can continue to become more effective and efficient for all parties. And third, with the inclusion of the compliance and state contracting proposals, this gives MDHR a more moderate and intermediate step that our department can take to help bring contractors into compliance if they're not working towards the state's equity hiring goals and equal pay protections. There was also a couple bills that specifically hit on disability discrimination, and I wanna highlight and applaud the inclusion of those. First is inclusion of the interactive process. This language ensures simply that employers and employees have to engage in a discussion, an interactive process, to see what reasonable accommodations may exist in the workplace. Just clarifies that and requires that. Second, we commend the inclusion of the organ transplant discrimination language so that no one with a disability is discriminated against for trying to access life-saving organ transplants. So in closing, I have been trying to make sure that I always share a story with you to demonstrate what our department's budget means for Minnesota. I'm not going to do that today. Today, I'm going to take a quick look back at the stories that I've already shared. There's Laura, a disabled veteran with a service-related disability, whose employer denied her the ability to bring her service animal to work. There's Jamisha, a Black woman who worked providing care to seniors in a living facility. She was repeatedly harassed for her race and ultimately fired because of her race. There's Kimberly. You remember her with the cute little kid. She's a parent who was fired because she took parental leave. I also shared the story of the 16-year-old seasonal lifeguard who was sexually assaulted at work. She reported it twice to supervisors. Neither took action. And most recently, when I testified, I talked about all of the qualified women who were denied jobs at Billiam Industries because they were women. Under the Minnesota Human Rights Act, We are responsible for upholding the civil rights of all Minnesotans. That includes Laura, that includes Jamisha, Kimberly, and every Minnesotan in every county. As I've shared with you before, we're a small people-powered agency fulfilling a big mission. So this funding that we're talking about today supports the dedicated staff who show up every single day to support Minnesotans. Thank you, committee. Thank you, Chair Becker Finn, for building a more equitable and inclusive Minnesota through this omnibus bill. We look forward to working with you for the remainder of session. Have a great day.
Thank you, Commissioner. With that, we will move on to the next testifier. I have Joanna Woolman. If you could introduce yourself and then go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you. Nice to see you, Chair Becker Finn. I'll be very brief. My name is Joanna Woolman, and I'm the director of the Institute to Transform Child Protection at Mitchell Hamlin. I'm also a professor of law there. And I want to offer brief testimony today to thank Chair Becker Finn and the committee for the inclusion of HF 312, which provides a right to counsel for indigent parents in child protection cases. This is a critical policy initiative for Minnesota. Minnesota is one of only 8 states that does not currently mandate the right to counsel for parents in child welfare cases. This is an important policy step, and I'm so thrilled that this language is in here. Thank you very much, Chair Becker Finn, for your hard work. I would also like to thank Representative Rena Moran, who worked on this bill in previous sessions. Thank you.
Right. Thank you very much, Ms. Woolman, Professor Woolman. With that, we will move on to the next testifier, Brett Grant. Brett, if you could introduce yourself for the record and then go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Becker Finn and members of the committee for supporting HF 306, Fines and Fees Reform. My name is Brett Grant. I am Research and Policy Director at Voices for Racial Justice. We're a statewide organization that envisions a world without racism that honors the culture, knowledge, power, and healing of Black, Indigenous, and communities of color. In 2020, we partnered with the City of St. Paul to conduct 2 community listening sessions on fines and fees and their impacts on the community. All participants had experience in the criminal justice system, both directly and indirectly. We had over 25 people sign up to participate. We held 2 sessions over Zoom, and the average turnout was 6 per session. We believe this was a result of doing the sessions over Zoom due to COVID-19. Participants were asked a total of 7 questions, 3 of which are relevant to this hearing. Question number 1, what has been your experience with having fines and fees? Question number 2, how has this impacted your ability to thrive and grow? And question number 3, if you had an opportunity to speak with elected officials regarding fines and fees, what would you share? Here are 3 quotes from the participants. Participant number 1, how the system is set up, I'm not safe, no one's safe from it. If the smallest thing comes in your life at the wrong time, it could be over. You're gonna be petty and make me pay money that I don't have and threaten me with jail? Participant number 2, I was in addiction for 15 to 20 years. I racked up a lot of fines. I'm almost 14 years into recovery, and I haven't got through half of them. They're set up for low-income people, people like me that can't pay and living in the system. My sister is in the system and is paying for restitution, and I'm paying, and I live in government housing. Stop sucking the life out of people with low income. Start hitting the people who do have money. They wonder why people who don't have money keep trying to take from people who do. And participant number 3, where's the human aspect of assessing fines and fees? Are some of these laws and statutes that we pay fines and fees for even necessary? So lastly, I want to thank Representative Frazier for your leadership on HF 306, this committee for hearing the bill and voting unanimously to support it, and Chair Becker Finn for including HF 306 in the omnibus bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony and drawing attention to that piece of the bill. The last public testifier I have on the list is Rich Neumeister. Mr. Neumeister, if you could introduce yourself for the record and then go ahead with your testimony.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Rich Neumeister, and I am representing myself. Comments are to page 56, line 15, to page 57, line 5. The proposed language is a major policy change, which is twofold. 1, it classifies data But secondly, it brings to attention to the policymakers and the public the activities of law enforcement in collecting mental health data, one of the most sensitive data about us Minnesotans. Law enforcement are now collecting and gathering mental health data, more so in recent years, because they have become the front line for people in crisis. Law enforcement is doing this in a non-investigative and helping way to connect the person in crisis for help. With that information, which is non-investigative data, sits on an electronic database gathered, collected, and used on many Minnesotans to provide direction and care for the individual, it should not be used to deny rights and privileges that law enforcement agencies or generally government oversees. This is a rationale for my suggestion that there should be an amendment that makes sure that this non-investigative data, helping data collected for helping the individual, not be used for other purposes. Over the past few decades, the legislature has developed how they keep data in baskets, which with rules about it, its acquisition and use. This proposal brings to attention what law enforcement is now currently doing, which undercuts valid and tailored public policies. Again, this is why I am suggesting language that the data collected, again, the non-investigative data to helping people, cannot be used for other purposes. There's a lot of rationale why it can, you know, people using information for other purposes or whatever. The second item is that, as you know, how the amendment was worked on with numerous parties. One of them is Minkoji. It is clear in the testimony, I believe, of Minkoji that certain data shall remain public when it becomes investigative data. It goes through what is under Section 7 of 1382. I think that needs to be clarified. So I am aware that Minkoji has suggested, in working with several legislators, some language to clarify that. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I want to thank you for the time. My feedback and suggestions are based on my long-time commitment, for no money, as all of you know, to make sure that government and institutions do not go beyond where liberties, rights, and public accountability are in jeopardy. So, Madam Chair, I thank you very much, and I can take any questions if there are any.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Neumeister. And as you noted, that provision and several of the data provisions in the bill. So essentially, we included that mini omnibus bill data bill in case we are not able to move that bill separately, that we've got it moving on a couple different tracks, depending upon how the Senate chooses to move forward with those bills. So that was something that we discussed in full in committee. I do want to also direct members, we don't have any other public testifiers signed up, but I do want to direct members, there are numerous letters that were submitted from various agencies and organizations. Those are all posted publicly on our committee website, and just would encourage folks to take a look at those. Now, if there are any additional questions about the bill or anything that committee members would like to weigh in. Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just had a question for the Commissioner of Human Rights, Ms. Lucero, Commissioner Lucero.
Chair Peckerfin, Representative Scott, I believe Commissioner Lucero had to hop off for a bit. I'd be happy to try to field the question now, however you want to proceed, Chair.
Yep, and that was Eric, also from the Department of Human Rights. So, Representative Scott, please go ahead with your question, and we'll pass it on
right.
to him.
Thank you. And I know that I have a Zoom call with the Commissioner and with Eric here later today, but I just wanted to ask the question on the record, because our conversation is about the rebuttable presumption that's in the equal pay bill. And as I said on the floor, I think you could get unanimous support. You could have gotten unanimous support of that equal pay bill had that presumption been taken out. So my question is if the argument is that it's already sort of built into case law, this presumption, then why do we need that in the language here? If it's not, why is it not in any other part of the Human Rights Act or that section of statute?
All right. So, Mr. McConkie, if you could introduce yourself and then go ahead. And then also, I know it's Representative Herr's bill and she's on as well. So, but we'll start with you, Mr. McConkie.
Thank you, Chair Becker Finn, Representative Scott. My name is Eric McConkie. I'm the Government Relations Director for the Minnesota Department of Human Rights. Thank you for that question, Representative Scott. So, the idea behind the rebuttal presumption language in this bill is that I think it's important to have a clear standard of expectations around the use of the pay history question. The pay history question is also a unique aspect of unique aspect of the Minnesota Human Rights Act, whereas the other areas of the act are specifically around protected class statuses. And so because the pay history question is a little bit of a unique aspect, we think it's important to set this clear standard that the use of the pay history question should not be used. And if it is going to be used, there you should have some clear reason as to why you're using it. I will say, I've appreciated the conversations we've had so far with you, Representative Scott, with members of the business community, other members on this committee, yourself, Chair Peckerfin, or Representative Hurst leadership. I think the bill we've seen is a collaborative bill so far. There's sections in that bill that have come directly out of conversations and feedback from the business community, from members on this committee. And so our department is committed to continue to work on this process together to ensure that we can help close it.
All right, thank you. Follow up, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm sorry, your feed was kind of breaking up as you were talking, so I don't know if other members could hear it very well either. I didn't get the whole gist of what you were saying. And I guess just a follow up question on the rebuttable presumption is, there are several other states that have this law and it's working fine without a rebuttable presumption. And so I'm just wondering, again, if it's working in other states and they're still able to enforce this law, why we need the rebuttable presumption in the language? Thank you, Madam Chair.
I'm going to go to Representative Herr if you're available, since you're essentially asking the same question. Representative Herr. I know despite her living in St. Paul, sometimes her her Wi-Fi connection is not the best. We will be meeting tomorrow morning, potentially tomorrow evening. We also have our Thursday slot. So, we can follow up more on that, Representative Scott, to hopefully get an answer to your question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't know if, since Representative Herr doesn't seem to be on, if Mr. McConkie wants to answer that question.
Mr. McConkie, if you want to try to answer that question.
Sure. Thank you, Chair Beckerfin. And sorry about I didn't realize my sound was not coming in well before. Is it okay now?
Sounds much better. Thank you.
Okay. To repeat, I'm sorry, the question was because, in the states that have passed similar bills, the rebuttal presumption language has not been included in those bills, so why is it included in this bill? Is that the question, Representative Scott?
Yes.
Thank you. Okay. Chair Becker Finner, Representative Scott. So when we were looking at other states' bills, almost all the other states have some form of a enforcement mechanism. Other states' bills have a civil penalties route that wasn't necessarily a route that we felt appropriate for this type of bill. And so when we were thinking of how, when you're putting forth a policy and you're putting forth a policy that you want to make sure is enforced, what are the different tools we can use in making sure we have some form of an enforcement policy? And that's why we took the rebuttal presumption route versus a civil penalties route.
Further follow-up, Representative Scott?
Madam Chair, again, if it's working in other states with a penalty, with penalties, then I don't understand why we did this where, we're doing a lot of reform, to justice reform and those sorts of things. And one of the fundamentals is that you're innocent until proven guilty. And I know that's more of a criminal term, but, when you enter into civil court, you should be entering on level playing field. And this puts the employer in this case on an uneven playing field, in my opinion. And so again, I wish we could change that. I would gladly support the bill, but thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. McConkie, for answering the questions.
Yeah, and I will say too, just to, for the record, this was sort of fully litigated on the House floor. I know that was a question that came up and was answered by Representative Herr on the floor. And to that, I just want to note too, I really was conscious of making sure, I know my first year in the legislature was shocked sometimes when omnibus bills came forward and they had all these provisions that were things we never actually heard during the regular committee meeting times. And I really made a point to make sure that this bill does include things that we've already, have fully gone through the committee process. Obviously, there were some tweaks here and there based on what we learned during the committee process. But I did think it was important that, we not sort of spring some new provisions that folks had never seen before or had not been introduced as legislation in the past. And so, just want to make that point because that was a conscious decision I made about this bill. Representative Scott.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll end my comments right about this right here. And I appreciate that you did put bills in the omnibus that we have already heard. There is a lot of policy in the budget bill, but that's another discussion. But the reason I wanted to ask these questions was because on the House floor, of course, the Commissioner of Human Rights is not present to ask the questions too. So that was my reason for wanting to ask them today on the record. So thank you for letting me do that. Thank you.
Yeah, I thank you, Representative Scott. And I will say, too, and I do think it's important because I do think our committee time, it's important for the public who's watching to understand, too, that I agree in a perfect universe, we would only have finance pieces in the omnibus bill. But unfortunately, when the other body is not really as open to moving things as standalone bills and is not, we put all this work into a policy on a small policy omnibus bill with those data provisions, and have not been able to move that forward yet. And so this is the reality we find ourselves in as far as being able to move things forward. And as I noted before, the bill would actually have been a lot shorter, except for the forfeiture bill does take up a big chunk of the bill. So, that's part of the reason for including some of those things. But again, I didn't, that was also part of the reasoning in posting our bill early is that I, didn't want it to be one of those things where we post it 12 hours before committee and folks don't have time to look through it and actually know what's in it before we come to committee. So with that, I will just note to remind folks, we'll be laying this bill over today and then coming back tomorrow to work on it for markup. So the amendment deadline is noon today, and we'll begin markup and then voting on amendments tomorrow. We do have an extra, not our normal committee time, but we'll be meeting at 8:30 tomorrow morning and then meeting for 90 minutes. And if needed, we will recess and come back in the evening to continue working on amendments and marking up the bill. And with that, I will lay over House File 1030 as amended is laid over. Before we adjourn today, members, are there any question about sort of the roadmap for the week? All right. Good. you know, like I said, we were really intentional in wanting to make sure that that information was posted early. And it's a very detailed posting with a lot of dates and times on it, but I wanted to make sure that was all out there for folks. So thank you, everybody, for your attention today. Thank you to our testifiers, as well as, again, our nonpartisan staff. And especially, I know being on camera is not their favorite part of their job. And so appreciate them walking through the bill with all of us today. With that, we are adjourned.